The Spinoff Podcast Network.
Talo for Lover. I'm Madeline Chapman, editor at The Spinoff. If you have the means, consider supporting our high-quality journalism by becoming a Spinoff member. Sign up now at thespinoff.co.nz/donate.
You're listening to Business is Boring, a podcast that reckons it's anything but. Business is Boring is brought to you by Spark Lab, offering inspiration and practical advice to help businesses find their edge. To hear more about Spark Lab, including details about the latest events, workshops, and business tools, visit sparklab.co.nz. And now, here's your host, Simon Pound.
Kia ora koutou katoa. Welcome to Business is Boring. Many people listening will know today's guest from his Instagram and TikTok persona. Albert Cho started Eat Lit Food, a boisterous and often like wonderfully profane series of restaurant reviews and meditations on life and food. He's also an author. He's a critic who writes and compiles best of lists with Viva, and recently has opened up Toby, a new restaurant on Ponsonby Road that's a roaring success as part of his work with the Namu Group. He joins us today to talk life quite openly in the spotlight, what he's up to and what's happening next. Thank you so much for joining us, Tanakwe.
Thank you for that beautiful improvised intro. That's great.
We're trying. I'm trying to make this like a podcast. Might be an idea, right? Hey, so a lot of people listening will know you from Eat Lit Food. How did that all start and begin?
Eat Lit Food actually began as a recovery platform for me because in my late teen years, I was a model and I was going on some crazy diets and I was very deprived of food. And anyone that's been deprived of food would know that their obsession of food becomes way more intense. So to maintain a very low weight that was given to me by my Korean agency at the time, I had to have just one meal a day. So that's all I could have. And for me, that one meal started to become an obsession because I couldn't have that meal be bad or else that just ruined my whole day because it's the only thing I can eat. So I started looking into reviews while I was modeling in Korea, and the reviews and the people in Korea, if I was doing what I was doing now in Korea, I would not have made it as big as I have because the reviewers there are so good. They're so detailed. Their photos are amazing. And then I came to New Zealand and back then it was Zomato, and I'm not really sure if many people had Zomato accounts, but a lot of them lacked pictures, which I found was a really crucial part in getting to have an idea of what you're about to eat. And a lot of them also, they wrote in a way where I wouldn't really talk and my peers wouldn't talk like that either. So I just kind of made an Instagram account for myself, which I actually already had it because my therapist at the time said, I need to find joy in eating again. A good way to do that is to just kind of build a social media to kind of track what you're eating as well, to make sure that you're still having an exciting relationship with food. So I started writing reviews on that account as well, but it was just for me and my friends to see, and it was in a tone that was very much so how a 20-year-old New Zealander would speak, how I would say a 20-year-old New Zealander would speak. So it included a lot of swear words. I think people just kind of gravitated towards the fact of it being quite relatable.
Yeah. And yeah, like exuberantly profane. Like I remember I think the first review of yours that I clocked, which is quite far in, was when you did the little pancake place at the top
that was ages ago. Yeah, number one pancake.
Yeah. And then the little like folded omelette thing with opposite like the Sky City Metro.
Jumping. Yeah.
And like,
wow, you're a loyal one.
That was magic because there was this like enthusiasm and love for, you know, foods that people could easily walk past and overlook, and just this like enjoyment of sharing.
Yeah.
But also just like just this happy glee.
Yeah. And
it was great.
And it was genuine happiness because I was discovering food again because I had a diet that was like an apple for breakfast, one kumara for lunch, and green tea for dinner.
Oh,
that was
what I was on for so long. And then I was doing the 1 meal a day and I was rediscovering food again. And that's why Eat Lit Food did have that sense of positivity and gleefulness, because it was actually me becoming really excited about eating again.
That is such a fucked thing to do to a young person, to send them into an environment, you know, as a modelling agency where you put those strictures on them.
Yeah.
Tell us about that. Like, what age were you, you know, scouted and sent to Korea to model?
I was scouted when I was 17, but my New Zealand agency, well, I need to get clear, my New Zealand agency was amazing.
Yeah.
And because the New Zealand market's also very different, they like men looking quite healthy. And then it was when I got an agency in Korea at around 19, that's when it started to kind of go downhill. So they thought my strength was having very androgynous features and they wanted to highlight that by having me at a very low weight. So I looked like both a woman and a man. So they put me on some vicious dieting and it sounds cliche, but I do genuinely believe that what happens in your past shapes you. And I'm quite happy with who I am today and where I've ended up. And if I didn't have those experiences as a model, I wouldn't have probably started the food account. So I'm in a weird, twisted way kind of thankful. And also, like, I was told since such a young age that I was replaceable. When you're a model, you're told that all the time. So when you're told at 19 that you're replaceable, it kind of instills this vicious work ethic in you to not be replaceable anymore and to find unique qualities about yourself. And that's kind of what I did, I think. So I do kind of hold my strong work ethic responsible to being a model when I was a kid.
And the discipline, right?
Like, yeah.
Because that feels, especially someone who obviously does, like, get so much joy from food. That discipline to deny yourself, and the way it kind of takes over your life and stuff, like, that's a horrible thing
It killed my relationships. Yeah. I dated a girl for 3 years, and what actually was the demise of that relationship was because I just couldn't do the normal thing of like eating out, going on dates. So it did take a lot of my youth, I would say. Yeah.
And was it, I mean, I hear you when you say, you know, it's contributed to where you are today, but kind of was it worth it? Like, were the jobs big enough? Was the life exciting enough? Like, as a model in Korea? Because it sounds kind of cool. Like, Korea is the center of so much culture and, you know, so many of these trends in fashion and body modification and makeup. And, like, and to make it there is like making it in New York, right?
Yeah. Like, I never had a plan and I still don't have a plan. And at that age, I was given a plan by those agents being like, this is what you're going to do and this is our plan. So you're going to spend this 3 months just going, meeting photographers, meeting scouts, meeting important people in the industry, and then go to school, finish uni, and then come back. And for that time when you come back, you're going to stay here for as long as possible and you're going to try build a career off of it. So that was a plan that was given to me. I was just kind of working towards that. So, yeah.
Yeah, but then you're only allowed to have 1 meal a day. So that's a bananas thing. And so it started as something to have a healthier relationship with food. But then it became a kind of a life of its own, right? Because your personality and more of you started to come through, which is why modeling seems so funny, because you're so charismatic. And then, you know, modeling like a photo, you know, like just captures you at a moment in time.
Yeah.
But can't possibly capture all your charisma and all of your charisma coming through the reviews, right? How did it start to build? And when were there turning points or moments where you knew it was kind of like taking on a life of its own?
There definitely were turning points, but I will say I had never seen something grow so naturally. And what I mean by that is that when I first started Eat Lit Food, it was quite surreal. I would go onto Instagram and I'd see New Zealand influencers just story my post and say, everyone should go follow Eat Lit Food because he's just so funny. And it was people like the 20s Club and Anna Reeve and Jay Reeve. And I still remember the people that did that. And they had a massive amounts of following and they were just sharing my account and putting it out there.
Cool.
Yeah. So for a while there was just like thousands of new followers a day were just organically growing.
Wow.
Yeah.
That must be so energizing.
It was
as well.
Cool. Yeah, yeah. Yeah. I genuinely believe in that serotonin kick when you have social media. I would say there are a couple turning points. The first one would be that bagel incident with like Goodness Gracious. I reviewed Goodness Gracious negatively and they replied to a negative review in a very sour tone. And it was obviously a really slow news day and it made national news. That was quite a turning point, I would say. And then the Whittaker's chocolate peanut slab and a pie was a turning point. I think I almost made like Mike Hosking throw up on air because he like tried it. That was a turning point. Yeah, there were just several things. Even now, like I opened up about like Botox and filler.
Mm.
And that was another turning point where I just got my name more out there nationally. But
yeah. And what's that like as a person to... Like, because, you know, you're living in public and you're sharing a lot about yourself there.
Mm.
And there's the positives where people are, like, excited and loving the humour. But also, like, it's pretty easy to, like, have the odd misstep or share too much or all of this stuff. And you're kind of growing and learning all in public.
Yeah. I didn't think anything of that while during my whole social media career and growing up in public. And I would say... 20 to 26 of quite formative years of who you become.
Oh man, I'm so lucky there's no records.
Yeah. But I'm beginning to realize that people who formed an opinion of me when I was 20, it's that same opinion that they have of me when I'm now 26. And I don't even know the person I was when I was 20. Like, it's just, that's quite a unique experience for me, I would say. I feel like I've grown up a lot, but for a lot of people, they just see glimpses, and I've had some major fuck up moments. Like, I used to like story myself like with a balloon and NOS cans at like 3 a.m. when I was 20. Like, and I had no sense of...
And your boss was like, are you going to be in at work tomorrow?
I had no sense of consequences. I was like, that's fine. And like, yeah. And then I would just do the most annoying shit publicly, and I'd go out and... make sure everyone knew I was out and make sure everyone knew what time I went home. And I was so public about all that stuff that I did definitely build this image around myself of becoming an absolute substance abusing bender.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And
true hedonism.
Yeah. But I think people go through that in their early 20s.
Yes.
And now I've grown out of that a lot. And even if I do go out, it doesn't have to be public information. But I feel like it's been quite interesting experiencing the same emotions people have towards me as they did when I was 20.
You've also used the forum, you know, the medium of this to explore some really interesting things in New Zealand culture, right? Like, I remember a post, and I don't remember the exact words, but you said something like, you know what's cool? The kind of food that got me bullied at school when I was a kid with my lunchbox is now the kind of food that the same bullies all want to eat and be seen and be associated with. And it's kind of that journey of like small-minded New Zealandness, which is still there everywhere, right?
Yeah, yeah.
But now like there is this explosion and flowering and excitement around so many different kind of like Asian cuisine and all of these elements. But tell us about that journey and like to see that change.
I mean, I think any kid who's not white in New Zealand has gone through a bit of lunchbox trauma when they bring something of their own culture. And even for like shared lunches, like people would bring a plate from home. I remember in intermediate, this girl brought like a plate of samosas and no one would eat it. Everyone made fun of her. But I don't say it sarcastically when I say I genuinely find it cool that now it's become almost a trend to really like international cuisine. It's almost become a thing that you want to be a part of because liking international cuisine shows that you're cultured and you're seasoned. So I do genuinely find that cool because and this might be problematic to say, but I see it as cultural appreciation, not appropriation. But I know a lot of people who find that like the Blueberries Inn is an annoying restaurant because it kind of took Asian cuisine and made it mainstream and is feeding it to white people. And now they're generating heaps of money from it. But I'm like, what else do you want? Like, I'd much rather have Asian culture, whatever culture, to be more accepted, whether the owner is white or no matter what color their skin is, and they're making money out of it.
It's cool if it's a gateway drug, eh?
Yeah.
Like, gets you in the door to go to new places.
The pork belly bao is a gateway to Chinese cuisine. It truly is. Just like the sweet and sour pork is. I'd say like kimchi fried rice and like kimchi cheese fries is a gateway to Korean cuisine, like Korean fried chicken. But yeah.
Mm. And also across that time, you know, going through a journey around sexuality in public. Mm. And every now and again, you know, you'd share some of the posts that come in. And that's hard, man. Like, people are people are, you know, anonymous people are often horrible and stuff, right? But yeah, tell us about that. Yeah, that experience.
I mean, that kind of ties into just me growing up in public. Like, I was still figuring out everything at 20, 21, 22. I hadn't even talked to my parents about sexuality. They found out through other people. It was a whole ordeal. But it definitely, like I said before, while I was doing it, I really didn't think anything of it. I didn't think there would be any consequences or impact. But now that I'm looking back at what I was doing then, I kind of just want to give myself a bit of a pat on the back, because like I said, you had no idea what you were doing and the repercussions that would come from it, because the amount I've been open has definitely impacted my family. Like right now, me and my family don't really have much of a relationship, because I think they've become very hurt at how open I was to the public, and that might have just translated as disrespectful to them. So, and dating became a lot harder, because I think a lot of people didn't want to be associated with someone that could, I mean, I guess it's like, I'm not comparing myself to Taylor Swift because I'm nowhere near as famous, but how people don't want to date Taylor Swift because they think she's going to write a song about them. You know, back in the day, if someone fucked me over, I would definitely blast them publicly. So, yeah.
Yeah. And then it also made for some of the most extraordinary food reviews ever, like talking about not having curries or something, yeah. You know, like quite remarkable. Yeah.
I still stand by those. I'm looking out for the girls and the gays. Like.
Yeah. And love that, like that kind of voice and that kind of energy. Like it was really cool to see you turn that into and give it the depth through your book and through your writing and stuff, right? Tell us about that process as going from a, you know, Instagram caption to a book. Yeah. Gives you so much more ability to give depth to things, right?
Yeah, the book. God, that book was kind of a whirlwind. I wrote that first draft of the book in 3 months, and then I kept refining it for about 7 more months. And at that time, I also had a full-time job at a marketing agency, so I would go home and then write the book. And it was, people ask me all the time like why I did it, and there was a phase where I was quite scared of people finding out about the real reason of why Eat Lit Food came to birth, about it being quite mentally health driven. And I thought that was just an area that I didn't want to be in because it's a lot of pressure. So in a lot of interviews, I kind of find myself lying a lot, and I almost want to just set the record straight with my own voice and just have a narrative that I could control, because there's always also so many things that people say about me that is beyond my control. And after writing for magazines for multiple years, I did want to write something just for myself. But the process, people ask me if it was like therapeutic because it was such an open book, but I don't think it was very therapeutic. I think therapy was therapeutic for me. If the book was a therapeutic process, I don't think I would have been ready to write or publish a book. So for me, it was actually quite easy to just let go and write. And thank God I had a publisher, Claire from Penguin, who was very, she understood my voice. So even when we had other proofreaders who would try change the way I wrote, she was just like, no, we're sticking with how he does it because he knows his voice the best and he knows his audience the best. I'm so glad that happened.
That's great. And through the book, and you know, you mentioned before the fillers and stuff, and through, you know, some just being open through TikTok and the like, telling the story of, you know, your journey around Botox and feeling a need for it and then kind of moving past it.
Yeah.
Sharing those stories is because no one shares the insecurities driving these things. No one shares the downsides of these things. They're such untalked about things. But it's massive, right?
Yeah, totally. And again, I keep saying this, but I don't realize when I'm actually doing it that it's something that some people might struggle with. But I've always gone off the basis of honesty and transparency is the key to not ever being cancelled. Because I feel like if I'm the one that's basically canceling myself, because I usually think people get canceled for something that comes up from their past or something that's been hidden and then it just gets exposed, but I'm constantly exposing myself and the only person I have to show for is myself. So I'm open and I have no problem being open, but I get customers at my restaurant being like, I read your book and there's this part where it really got to me, like you were sexually assaulted as a kid, and then they talk about how that really touched them. I'm just like, I almost forgot that I put that in there. And I'm like, fuck, I actually published that in a proper book, but okay, yeah.
And I think a lot of people with backgrounds that have been, you know, conservative, trying to find their own way to express themselves, like it's just a universal challenge, isn't it?
I would say so. I would say my sister and I are quite different, as in she can't really express herself. And if she does, it's done in a very thought out, calculated way. Whereas when I express myself, it's done in a very spur of the moment. And sometimes it can bite me in the ass. But I mean, in my family, in Korean culture in general, I would say, and especially for men, I would say expressing yourself and talking about your feelings and your weaknesses is not something that's celebrated. So it is quite unique, I think.
Yeah. I mean, I disappointed my poor dad terribly because he was very Catholic. And and part of my pushing away from that was to really question, like, you know, if the Catholic Church set up tomorrow and like a bunch of people came out of nowhere and said, hey, we're going to like ritualistically eat some flesh and drink some blood.
Yeah.
Not like, you know, metaphorically, like we actually believe we're like drinking some blood and we're going to do that down the road. Yeah. Cool if we set up.
Yeah.
Maybe we could like teach your kids. Yeah. You'd be like, get out of here, you know? Yeah. And so that kind of, I'd share those kind of views and just break his heart, you know?
But my parents are Catholic too, my God.
Yeah. It's real. It's real.
It's a whole thing, isn't it?
There's part of your kind of growing.
I'm like the worst nightmare for Catholic parents, but. Here we are.
And what does the business side of all of that kind of work out to with the Instagram following? Because you got like, you know, 60,000 plus on the Instagram or something, right? And how does that work in a small market like New Zealand? And that people probably think because you're as much a public figure in their lives as people on the TV.
Yeah.
And you know that things are all shiny and easy, but pretty hard to make a living out of a New Zealand scale thing.
Oh, hey, yeah.
How do you stitch all that together and how does that work as a business?
I mean, I was doing Eat Lit Food full time, so just Instagram, when from 2020 to 2020, end of 2021. And I was quite miserable, I would say. I was, for me, I'm not a regular freelancer. Influencers aren't regular freelancers. We're not graphic designers that are contracted on and actually working. Whoever says influencing is harder than it looks is a liar. It's one of the easiest jobs you can ever do. It is. Like, it truly is. Like, you just have to take some photos and write a caption and that's it. And you get paid thousands for it. Like, it's crazy. And I was so young and I was making... There were some months when I was raking in like over 30 grand in a month.
Whoa.
Yeah, just from Instagram.
It's like OnlyFans money.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. That was when I was like saying yes to everything. Yes to any campaign that came my way. But
that's a pretty good living for someone in their early 20s, right?
I think when I was only like 23 and I was living like I was retired. And I was, when you're that young as well and you're kind of have tendencies to have a lot of, want to chase a lot of fun. When you have that amount of money, of course I got addicted to drugs. Of course I was drinking so much because I had the means to do so. So yeah, it was actually really dangerous. And that's why I fell into quite a bad slump around 23, 24, when I was just going out way too much, finding any excuse to just use any substance. And I don't think anyone can actually prepare anyone in their early 20s for that sort of money to come in so fast before such little effort. So when I turned 24, I remember having a bit of a panic attack because I was like, if I'm doing the same shit like this when I'm 25, that's when I know something's got to change. So after that 24th birthday, I was like, I need to just find some routine, find a proper job, 9 to 5. So I started working at Mark by South at the marketing agency for like 2 years. And that's probably something that was the best thing I could do for myself. Yeah.
And just as a final, we'll wrap up on the kind of influencer and come back in a second to talk about the restaurant. And that, like, I remember years ago, I worked with Paul Henry on a TV show called Agenda before he became Paul Henry.
Mm-hmm.
And he'd just come back from overseas and he was like a, you know, investigative journalist kind of character. And he had all of the qualities that made him Paul Henry, but he wasn't Paul Henry yet, if you know what I mean. Like, and it was really interesting to, so everyone who's ever worked with him is kind of like loves him because he's charismatic and friendly and like looks after people around him and is actually really interested in people. Right. But then over a few years, as he became kind of doing the breakfast show and you know, the Paul Henry show, and he kind of became a caricature of himself a bit because people expected him to be always up to 11, a bit provocative, a bit out there. And it was really interesting to see him actually turn more and more into kind of a caricature as his public persona. And he's still great. Like, you know, everyone who knows him personally still loves him. But like, and that was always really fascinating to me. And I wonder, do you, as having a public persona, if you're living large, does everyone expect you to be the life of the party? And does that then push you into kind of like becoming what people expect?
Yeah, I would say, and I can't blame them. I, for so long, I was known for being this chaotic party animal who was always out and just bendering all weekend. And that's a wrongdoing that I do on myself. That I do think people just expect me to be that 24/7. And even when I was going out a lot, I would get people that were recognizing me, come to the bathroom with me and do a line. And I'm like, you're fucking crazy. I don't know you. And like, why would I go do that with you? And then they'd almost go like, you're full of shit. And then I've had someone like lose it at me because I wouldn't do a line with them in the bathroom. And I'm like, I don't want to do anything with a stranger. I don't know what stuff you have. I don't know how I can contact you if I fuck out. And he actually got really angry at me and he felt like I catfished him basically. And I would say that's even a thing now. People expect me to be a lot more, because I swear so much and I used to swear a lot more. I think there's this misconception that people think I like walk into a room and be like, yo, what the fuck is up? And just be really like boisterous and stuff. But I've always been brought up to have manners, and I find manners is like the most important quality for any person. And that's almost like a juxtaposition and quite shocking for people when they meet me in person, I would say.
Yeah, love it. And we'll be back in a moment with Albert to talk moving into running restaurants, opening Toby, and what's next. Spark is proud to partner with the Sustainable Business Network and the Climate Action Toolbox. The free Climate Action Toolbox can provide you with simple step-by-step guides to measure and reduce your emissions. Help lead the way to a low-carbon future for New Zealand. Visit sparklab.co.nz/sustainability to find out more.
Ready to rediscover the joys of cycling? With over 300 kilometres of cycle paths across Tāmaki Makaurau, jumping on your bike and going for a ride is such a fun way to discover the city from a different perspective. Cycling is getting more and more popular across Auckland, so now's a great time to join the hype and give cycling a go. Head to at.govt/cycling to find your nearest cycleway today.
Hoki mai anō, welcome back to Business is Boring, where we're with Albert Cho of Eatlet Food and lately the Namu Group. So tell us, how did you get involved with that? Because, you know, again, from just watching the stories and following along, seems like a pretty dream job, right? Great crew, great restaurants, tasting menus for a job. Like, tell us about that.
Yeah, I actually never thought how it could be perceived by other people, but it does sound pretty fun. I got involved with Namu Group because I was working at that marketing agency, Mark by South, and I had known David Lee since I was like 18 because the Korean community in Auckland is so small. And I've always really respected him because he's just made such a big name of himself in New Zealand, which is very impressive. But so we've been friendly. And then he approached Mark by South to do the marketing for his restaurant in Ponsonby called Igo. And that was the first time we ever worked together. And we had great synergy and we aligned on a lot of ideas, just creative ideas. And then he told me that he was planning on starting his own hospitality group and he needed someone quite young. And I mean, it takes a really big person to admit that they're getting old. And David actually said, I'm getting old. And the thing is, with age, I start to become less with it, with the times. The finger's not on the pulse anymore. And for hospitality, that's a very crucial part. So I think you'd be a great addition to my team. And for me, I thought David would be someone that added value to my life and my career, because while I was doing Eatlet Food full time, I would get people coming up to me saying, I have a restaurant, could you do some consulting? And I had no idea where to start with consulting because all I knew how to do was eat. I had no idea what the ins and outs were to a restaurant. So I actually really wanted to get into knowing the business a lot more. So here's someone that could offer me valuable life lessons in terms of valuable business lessons in terms of owning restaurants and operating restaurants. So that's how we started working together.
And tell us a little bit about the restaurants that they've that are in the Namu group and that David's been part of. They're pretty legendary, right?
Yeah, yeah. Like David's been a part of, he started in like this little Browns Bay cafe called Ben Gusto, and then he moved on to Little King Cafe in Milford, then Deja Voice, then he had Simon and Lee, Good Dog, Bad Dog. Then there was the Candy Shop. Then there's Pony, and then there's Igo, and then there is Toby. And what other ones? I think there are a few more, but I just forgot them. Yeah.
And like that kind of food style, super international, and like actually international style things don't always fly in a small kind of parochial kind of company, right? Country like. With Igo?
Mm-hmm. Igo, yeah.
Igo, with Igo. You actually helped like name it, come up with some of the visual and kind of creative concept and stuff, right?
Yeah. With Igo, all the branding was done already, and that was not our thing. But I would say the name of it was created by me. Igo means oh my in Korean, and I liked how it had a double meaning in Korean, and Igo just was like Igo, you know, quite literally. So I thought it was cool how it had a meaning in English as well. So I think that was our first kind of realization that we could work together. And then even with his menu, I told him that there's something lacking, as in every restaurant has like this handheld thing. Like Depot has their fish sliders, and then there's the pork belly bows from Blueberries Inn. What is Igo's one? And he kind of didn't think of that. And then I was like, no restaurant in Auckland is doing the crispy rice spicy tuna. Everyone's doing it in LA. I don't know why no one's caught on here. So he did that, and it became one of his best-selling items in the restaurant. So I think little like glimmers like that made him kind of see me in a bit of a different way, where he thought I did have potential in the restaurant industry. And yeah, that's how we kind of began.
And people watching along would have seen the process that went into opening Toby, from kind of the concept and the bringing together all of the kind of creative elements. It's quite a big site. And if you're kind of like a hospo person in Auckland, it's not an easy site either, right? Like there have been a few things that haven't quite landed there. What's the process when you go into something like that? Because that's kind of opportunity on one side, in the people, it's there to take. But then also, that's a big old space.
Yeah, I mean, it is huge. And after we did the fit out, I realized how big it was.
I was like,
holy shit when I saw it. And it is a tricky site. It really is. Because in comparison to how many people it seats, the kitchen is tiny. And we don't have a prep kitchen. We do everything in that little kitchen in the corner. Hence why there can be wait times on food. And that's just how it is with that restaurant, because it is a really difficult one to operate, and we just have to do the best we can. And we stretch it out from morning to night. We're a breakfast, lunch and dinner restaurant. So we are operating to optimal potential. I think I only could have done Toby because I didn't know anything better going in. If I had owned previous restaurants before and knew the ins and outs of how sizing works for kitchens compared to restaurants, I probably would have been quite scared and not done it. But David's a fearless leader. That's one thing he is. He's just like, if he has a goal, he does it. And his team members, JD, Tom, and Jay, they fearlessly follow along with him, which I actually admire. So I kind of fearlessly followed along in a way where it wasn't on purpose. I just didn't know any better, but it is a giant site. And I now, operating there, I can easily see why so many businesses have failed there.
What's the concept behind it? As it's kind of cool to be able to bring together, like some of the menu items have personal stories to you, like the name is a friend.
You know,
and there's obviously some things that are very true to your understanding of how people like to socialize, right?
Yeah.
Like happy hour drinks,
yeah.
really approachable cocktails, yeah. all of those kind of yeah. elements. Like what's, how do you describe it? What's the mix you're going for there?
I mean, someone asked me like, what's the cuisine over here? And I was like, I guess it's just a basket of deliciousness. Like it's just like anything that's yum, because we started off as like a, yeah. Quite a European bistro restaurant, and more, I think when people expected, when people envisioned a restaurant of me and David, people wanted something a bit more exciting. And I went on a trip to LA, and then I would go to restaurants there, and I'd go to some great Italian restaurants, and then I'd see like sushi rolls on their menu. And I asked the waiter, you know, what is your concept here? And they're like, it's LA, there's no concept. We do anything that's yum and anything that sells. And I was like, it kind of broke the boundaries for me a little bit. Yeah, so I yeah, came yeah. back to Auckland, and then I like told David about it, and he was like, I've been telling you this since we opened, because David was like, we're Asian people, there's no reason why we shouldn't have Asian influences in the, on the yeah. menu.
Like it's our turn to fusion, yeah, motherfuckers.
Yeah. But he was like, yeah, and he was like, there's nothing holding us back, just yeah. go all in. And yeah. then I don't know what was holding me back from doing that. I think I wanted to do something that people didn't expect. But as soon as we started putting anything we want on the menu, like prawn toast and Sichuan cabbage and shit, it's just become busier than ever, and people are liking it a lot more. So, yeah.
And kind of elevating some things that could yeah. be, you know, like, talk us through the chicken rolls, right?
Oh, yeah,
like,
yeah, yeah.
That's kind of cool, because who doesn't love
yeah,
a chicken roll?
Chicken. Yeah. yeah. I mean, that was inspired by my brother, Izzy, and he held this intervention with me back when I was doing, like, going out a lot, and he was like, you're about to step into a really important role and you need to get your shit together and find the balance between working and playing. And then he made me lunch, and someone said that people call this a bachelor's handbag, the supermarket chicken.
Yeah, yeah.
The supermarket roast chicken. And then he got some buns and he made me some chicken rolls. And I knew for Toby, I wanted some nostalgic dishes on the menu, because nostalgia, I think, is one of the most powerful elements in food. And who doesn't eat chicken buns in New Zealand? So I thought it would be great to put a gourmet version of that on our menu. And even the way we elevate dishes, though, like our clam pasta. David is an Asian man, so when he's like, something's missing, his mind goes, like, let's like add a dash of shoyu. And that makes a huge difference. And those little like Asian influences on our menu isn't actually done completely intentionally. It's just how we know food.
Like, this is how we do umami.
Yeah,
it's like,
yeah, exactly.
Let's just get some more in there.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. So as soon as we start doing things that were authentic to us, I would say we've been seeing the growth and success. But, and like the name of the restaurant is also something, Toby, like she's one of my dearest friends, but it's not something, it's, there's not a real cool story behind it, to be honest. It's like Jay and Tom, David and I were sitting around the room trying to name this new restaurant that we have. And Jay and Tom are very Korean people whose English is their second language. So they're like, how about we name the restaurant Amazing Restaurant? Or like, how about we name the restaurant Gorgeous Restaurant? And they're just like coming up with the shittiest ideas. And then at that moment, Toby texted me. Yeah. And I saw the name, T-O-B-I, and it was just, it looks nice. Yeah, and I was like, yeah. What about Toby? And then David was like, what do you mean? I was like, T-O-B-I, like with an I in the end. And he was like, okay, let's do it. It was
all the way of like, ship it.
Yeah, he was yeah. like, that's the best we're going to get. So let's do it.
And what's been harder? And what's been easier? Because I guess after years of being a writer, because you know, I mean, there have been the odd restaurant that you've, or you know, outlet that you've said, you know, I actually just don't think they're doing something that's yeah. interesting enough. But you don't really go out to like rip people to pieces. It's far more yeah. being a persona around like celebrating the things
yeah.
you love and
yeah.
like going, hey, this could be better, but yeah. not going out just to try and rip shit.
Yeah,
right?
yeah, yeah.
But like, how's it helped you understand more about like the pressures of like, putting together a restaurant and all of those elements?
Oh my God. Like, it's completely changed how I see restaurants. I sit down in a restaurant now and I look at how many people they have on the floor. And I'm like, what are their labor costs like? And that's how I think about restaurants now. But I've actually, I do think people think I was a lot harsher than I really was. I never, ever complained about wait times on food, because I always saw restaurant workers as just normal people, and there's always something going on at a restaurant. So I always understood things like delays, or even if there's like hair in my food, it will never make it into a review, because I'm like, it's fucking hair. Like it's
most people have quite
yeah,
a lot.
Yeah, yeah. Like no one. sorry. But I'm like, I'm not. It's like I'm not gonna die over a strand of hair. You know, just shit happens. But now that I own my own restaurant, it's, I mean, the hardest thing I would say is people management, because I care for my team and my staff so much, but there's never a time where everyone's happy. It's like a room of crying babies. You know, there's never a time when there's all not crying. There's always one, something's going on, you sort out that problem and then something else goes on and another person's unhappy. And then whether it's something going on in their personal life or if there's something going on with how they're not happy with how their job's unfolding, there's always something going on with people. And I would say that is one thing that I didn't expect to be so challenging. And like the first time I got someone handing in their resignation, like a staff member that I really value, it like cut me deep. And I was like, but I keep having to like think and like remind myself, like, this is, these are people that have their own trajectories in life and you have to respect that. I knew though before opening Toby that because I have built my platform basically critiquing restaurants, the moment I put myself in the position that can be critiqued and reviewed, it was not going to be pleasant. Because it's almost like some people are waiting for this moment. And I did have a customer in the first month of opening come in, and he came in by himself, and he was like, after the dinner, he was like, to be honest, I came in here wanting to hate it, and there are a lot of people that want to see you fail. And I was like,
yeah, okay. Nice to meet you.
Nice to meet you. And then he was like, but I was pleasantly quite surprised, but yeah. And I was like, okay. And then that was it. And I do feel like I knew it would be quite harsh, and even like Google reviews and stuff, like one mistake gets us a one star, and people are like really, really quite critical in the way they talk about the restaurant. I was ready to handle that because I've read so much shit about me for so long, but I unfortunately didn't think of how my staff would deal with it. And I've had moments where members of my team have felt really flat from reading really negative reviews when they're trying their best and we're all working so hard to do such a good job, but just one little hiccup can get them just shat on. So I think that's been quite a challenging part. Just, I feel quite bad for my team that my past of critiquing restaurants has made them face the consequences a little bit.
And how fun is hospo? I used to work as a waiter in the Sky City Dime by Peter Gordon restaurant for years.
Where are you?
Like years ago. You know, we're talking like that's, you know, 100 years ago, right? And I loved it. Yeah. I loved the whole, and you used to work as a barman before that, which was a bit of a different kind of thing. But mm-hmm. the restaurant life of like taking people on a journey in an evening, and like you say that now you sit down and you see all the things. Mm-hmm. Like it, you have to kind of decouple and not worry about whether yeah. your cup's full of water or yeah. whether someone seems to be onto it, and just yeah. kind of breathe in, breathe out, right?
Yeah.
But the rhythms of a restaurant, the energy of a shift, the way that like yeah. the chef team are kind of like they're in the army yeah. and the waiters are like they're in the theater.
Yeah, yeah, totally. Awesome. I would say like other than like musicians performing in stadiums and like athletes performing a game in front of an audience, restaurants, owning restaurants and being in hospitality is that rare industry where you get instant gratification. There's not a lot of jobs out there where you perform your duty and straight away you get a response. So with restaurants, if a customer's happy, you are told within a second that they're happy. You can see it in their expression. I feel like that instant gratification is why people get quite hooked and addicted to hospitality, because that high you receive on a busy night and everything's going well, it is like you think you'd be tired after like working for 12 hours, but yeah. after it, you're like, I'm ready to go out.
You're buzzing.
Yeah, you go home and like you're trying to lie in bed and it's just impossible. You're buzzing.
Yeah.
And I feel like there is that addiction element to hospitality. And I definitely feel that now, like when it's a good night and when it's a good day, it's just like there's nothing like it. And, yeah,
super hard business though, right? Like the ones that work fantastically. Yeah. And if you kind of crack the code, like a Prego or something, yeah. you can kind of like
totally
become an institution. But then you look at like, there's so many openings and people put so much into fit out.
I know.
Yet every single element of the restaurant is either stealable, breakable, perishable.
I know.
You live or die on whether like the rain's good and the All Blacks win.
Yeah.
It's like, it's pretty, you're pretty exposed, right?
It's so hard. Like on your restaurant, especially in this climate right now, it's really hard. And I count my blessings every night when we're busy. I would say I can't deny the power of social media like TikTok and Instagram, because I know that's where a lot of our customers come from, and that's a fact because they literally show me my video being like, well, what's this? Can I order this? Yeah. So I find that we're so lucky that we are busy, but right now it's a hard industry to be in. And even when it's not a recession, it's like, there are just so many things in the restaurant that can go wrong. And even if like your staff are happy, suddenly your pipes blow up, and then you have to call in the plumber, like an emergency plumber. And then when that's fixed, your lighting blows out, and it's just like, and then your Wi-Fi goes down. Like last night, my Wi-Fi went down, so we couldn't take payments for like 20 minutes. So I'm like, there's always something going wrong. But like I said before, that instant gratification is kind of what keeps you there, I would say.
And you're kind of making a world, and there's something beautiful about that,
yeah,
right?
Yeah.
And like, as a final couple of thoughts, like, what would your advice be for people? I mean, you must have so many people talk to you about all kinds of issues because you've, you know, publicly talked about things that people struggle with and don't talk about publicly, right? But what would your advice be? I think the thing I'd be really interested to know is for someone who, like, you know, is so in the public eye, you know, how do you protect yourself? How do you look after yourself through all of that?
How do I protect myself? That's a good question, because I'm only starting to really figure that out myself. Opening this restaurant has taken a physical toll on me quite badly, because I've been doing like morning to midnight shifts almost every day. And not just like 3 weeks ago, I've been starting to take a few days off a week. And even on my days off, I can't really take a full day off. But one of the other operations managers in Namu, her name's Rachel, and she said, like, take care of yourself because no one else is going to do it for you. And I found those were actually quite strong words that stuck by me. Like, if you don't take care of yourself and open up on how you're feeling, you just start to grow resentment towards the thing that's making you work hard. So I definitely had like a little glimpse of feeling resentment when I saw Toby full, which was when I knew there's something wrong here with me, because I think it was after like, it was just after a busy week, and then it was a Sunday morning, and I went to Toby for a shift, and it was a packed out restaurant, and I was like, fuck, like, fuck, like, really? And like, I caught myself and I was like, you're in the middle of a recession, all these people are out here to eat at your restaurant, and that's actually supporting you. Why the fuck are you angry? So I knew that from that moment, I really need to take care of myself. And I would say just protecting myself is genuinely, when you're resting, you are resting, and you shouldn't just be doing something like when you're working, you should be 100% working, and when you're resting, you should be 100% resting as well. And even keeping, I've definitely gone through a lot of culling with people. I think I have like 5 friends now, but I used to have like a really wide group of friends. I feel like even not necessarily even if they've done anything wrong to you, if they're not adding value to your life and they're not making your life better, there's actually no reason to keep those people there. And they're actually, as now that I've become a much busier person, you start to value your energy a lot more and where you put it, and actually seeing that value for what it is and cherishing it, I think is a way to protect yourself. Yeah.
And as a final thought, like, you're so young still to have done all this stuff, right? Like, it's kind of crazy. What will success be for you? And how are you thinking about that at the moment?
Success? I genuinely don't know. Like, I don't even know what I'm doing in the next year. With anything in life, though, I never knew what I was doing. With modeling, I kind of fell into that. Eatlet Food, I kind of fell into that. The book kind of fell into that. And then with this role in this restaurant, I've been very lucky that I've been given a lot of opportunities, and I've taken them by the balls. And my advice to anyone who is wondering if they should do something or not is, if you're not going to stick to it, then don't do it. Because I think the only difference between Eatlet Food is with other food accounts, yes, there was that unique tone, but you look at food accounts and you see them post for like 6 months and then they drop off. Whereas Eatlet Food was something that was very consistent. For like 4 years there, I posted every single day at 11 a.m. So consistency is how, what got me this far. And I guess for me, it's just staying consistent with whatever I do. And if I ever leave Toby, it'll be done in a way where it's not just me being like, I'm pulling the plug. It'll be done in a way where it's, I actually put a conclusion to that chapter in my life and move on. But I don't know what success looks like or what my next chapter is. And I like it that way, to be honest. Yeah.
Yeah, I love it. Well, thanks so much for coming and sharing and chatting with us today. It's been such a pleasure.
Thank you.
Yeah, and yeah, can't wait to see what you make happen next. Albert Cho of Eat Lit Food and Namo Group. Kia ora. Thank you so much to Albert, and thank you very much for having us along in your ears and listening. And thanks to everyone who helps make this happen, like our producer, Te Ai Hei Butler. If you do like what we do, rate and leave us a review. E no hora.
From the Spinoff Podcast Network, that was Business is Boring. Brought to you by SparkLab. Make sure you're following Business is Boring wherever you get your podcasts. And for more information on SparkLab, visit sparklab.co.nz.
Kia ora e te iwi, Te Ai Hei Butler here, podcast manager at The Spinoff. If you enjoy listening to our podcasts, consider supporting our mahi by signing up to become a Spinoff member at thespinoff.co.nz/donate.
The Spinoff Podcast Network.